Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. Last week, we began our conversation with Joel Kotkin. He is the co-author of an article that you can find on dailybeast.com. It's entitled, As the Old Faiths Collapse, the Greens, Social Justice Warriors, and Techno-Futurists Aim to Fill the Void. A little bit about our guest. Described by the New York Times as America's Uber geographer, Joel Kotkin is an internationally recognized authority on global economic, political, and social trends. His new book is The Human City, Urbanism for the Rest of Us. Mr. Kotkin is the Presidential Fellow in Urban Futures at Chapman University in Orange, California, and Executive Director of the Houston-based Center for Opportunity Urbanism. He is the executive editor of the widely read website newgeography.com and writes the weekly New Geographer column for Forbes.com. He is a regular contributor to The Daily Beast and Real Clear Politics. He's the author of 7 previously published books, including the widely praised The New Class Conflict, which describes the changing dynamics of class in America. Other books include The Next 100 Million, America in 2050. The book explores how the nation will evolve in the next 4 decades. The City, A Global History, and Tribes, How Race, Religion, and Identity Are Reshaping the Global Economy. So we welcome once again to Common Threads, Joel Kotkin. Hello, Joel.
Hi.
Hey, last week we ended right when you brought up the subject of ideologies on college campuses. And that's something that always fascinates me. And one of the reasons is because I've spoken to so many people who clearly identify themselves as progressives and liberals, and yet find themselves the victim of some sort of ideological purity shaming. That you just can't be progressive enough. I don't know if there is a counterpart in certain uber conservative circles, but clearly on college campuses, this exists. And you were talking about how there is a tremendous disparity between the number of professors, say, in divinity schools who are liberal versus conservative. I think the numbers that you give in your article is there is one conservative to 70 progressives. That's right. Astounding. How does that happen? I mean, if there's an opening at a school and somebody applies and the powers that be find out this person happens to be conservative, do they just not interview them? Or are there actually more progressives vying for the jobs than conservatives?
Well, I think there are several things going on, and this is in the new book about neo-feudalism, which will be out in May. This is a parallel that we have to the Middle Ages, which is that not only do we have if not theological, ideological sort of tyranny going on. In other words, you have to agree with this, and this, and if you're not, you're a bad person. Very similar to how the church operated, the Catholic Church operated in the Middle Ages. And there's always a pressure within when you have a common dogma for people to say, okay, I'm going to push it further. Like, for instance, if you take, let's say, the gay marriage and gender equality, which are two very, things that I would support. But then it starts becoming, well, when you start saying, well, children, when you raise them, we shouldn't have them, identify as male or female. I mean, you start to, in other words, you keep pushing the agenda further and further and further out. Part of the problem that religion faces is that agenda pulling has become part of the religious situation. So that, for instance, you might be at your synagogue and you may be a moderately conservative person, for instance, and then your rabbi is basically you know, doing talking points taken, you know, that would be in the nation or in, you know, some, you know, fairly far left situation. So you see this being imposed and a kind of orthodoxy, and that orthodoxy is not just in religious terms, but in sort of more ideological terms. How do you say, I mean, when you start having people saying, well, you know, we're going to have to change the pronouns that we've been using for the last, you know, 1,000 years or whatever, where, you know, this constant desire of upping the stakes all the time. And, of course, this happens during periods that when people are confused. I mean, this is what happened during the Counter-Reformation in Europe, you know, where, you know, in order to stamp out heresy, one had to take ever more difficult positions. And so we're seeing something, you know, some of the worst aspects of religion being adopted by political movements, and the religions themselves being sort of taken down, I think, by ideologies that many parishioners don't support, and particularly at the same time that the churches, as we've discussed in the past, have become more and more dominated by older people. So the very people who are more likely to disagree with some of the progressive policies are the last people who are attending your church. And so, you know, I think that the religions, as they've adopted this point of view, I think are sort of causing some of their own downfall.
Yeah, I remember the very first time I received an email. It was from a prospective guest who worked at a college. And I'm going to use the pronoun she, in that most people would call that person if they spoke to this person on the phone or saw this person right in front of them, would use the word she pretty obviously. But in the email, at the bottom, it said pronouns colon zim zem zur. And I had no idea what that meant, none whatsoever. I didn't know that they were pronouns that she preferred. They were it could have been in Chinese. Pronouns colon zim zem zur. And I can't remember how I finally figured it out that this is what this person wanted to do, wanted to be referred to as. But I thought it was so absurd to do a program and refer with those pronouns that the audience wouldn't get. I was able to do 2 shows with this person and not use a pronoun once. I just used the some linguistic gymnastics to get out of that. But you're right. I see that. And as I say, when I speak to people, say, but I'm liberal, I'm progressive, but I can't do that easily. It's a challenge. I get that.
And I think that this is, I think that what religions are forgetting is, what is their primary mission? And I think the primary mission of a religion is, you know, to give spiritual comfort, to connect people with their own traditions. You know, whether it's the Black Church or a synagogue, its job is to fill the gaps in people's lives that they have spiritually, and to be focused on the community. And in the work I do, particularly in the Jewish community, our primary mission should be serving our seniors, serving our young people, giving family support when they need it. And you know, the more successful religions, for instance, the LDS, we generally call Mormons, they have done that. It's interesting that during this current problem with the coronavirus, probably the state in the best shape for handling it is Utah.
Is that right?
Yeah, and Utah does things in part because it is an important part of the LDS theology to serve people in general, to be ready for emergencies. And that, I think, is an important role that churches can play and synagogues can play that will sustain them and justify their continued existence.
Let's talk about larger families within religions. From what I understand, in Orthodox Judaism, Mormonism, some evangelical or Pentecostal sects, very conservative Catholics, all have large families here in the United States. Muslims in other countries, but not here. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think that's generally true. Although, you know, again, we don't have large families, even among these groups that we used to have. Just the economics just don't work. But they're more likely, certainly, to have children. I mean, it's very unusual to find a person who is, let's say, in Orthodox synagogue who doesn't have three kids. Same thing with religious Catholics or evangelicals. They're going to have 2-3 kids. The big trend is, you know, we talk about nuns in religion. We might also want to talk about nuns in terms of children, that there are so many people who simply never have any kids, maybe one, very often none. And that is one of the things that I think over time may bring back somewhat of a religious revival. I mean, in terms of talking about what may, you know, some of the positives, because we've been focused a lot on negatives. One is, as Eric Kaufman wrote about in The Religious Will Inherit the Earth, basically he makes the point that since the secular people don't have kids, it's going to be game over for them. I mean, San Francisco does not reproduce itself. But Tulsa, Oklahoma does. And so I think that there is the religions may survive long term because they have they encourage people to have children, and they also give them the tools to sustain that. You know, similarly, I think one of the more exciting things is the new generation coming up, the Z's, who are the ones after the millennials, may be a little more open to religion and a little bit more open to belonging to a church or synagogue. In part, they always react against the generation above them. But also, I think, because they see the results of that cultural dearth. My youngest daughter is 15, and she's very involved with the interfaith here in Orange County. Actually, she's the Jewish representative on the board. And so I think that among her generation, of the kids who are involved in their religion, they may be actually more involved in it, and they see the purpose of it. So I do think that, A, demographics, and B, the creation of the next generation may have a more promising result than we see among the millennials.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Threads here on WGVU-FM. I'm Fred Stella, and with me today is Joel Kotkin. He's the co-author of a recent article, As the Old Faiths Collapse, the Greens, Social Justice Warriors, and Techno-Futurists Aim to Fill the Void. And let's talk about those techno-futurists. What is one of those?
Well, this is something that's come out of Silicon Valley to a large extent, but it's also in other places. And this is the idea that we can live virtually, that what they call the singularity of where you essentially marry machine and the human. And that becomes a way of having some form of immortality. They'll talk about, for instance, Ray Kurzweil is probably one of the leading advocates of this. We download our intelligence and everything into the cloud, and we live forever. I mean, there's this notion of moving towards immortality. Obviously, it has different forms. Like, for instance, we could place our brains in some form of android and live forever. I mean, there's this desire to live forever, which has always been in religion, but now there is a kind of technological approach to this, which we've never had before, and I think that's become a force over time that we, and I think it's going to be particularly true of those who have access to money, because one of the things we already know is that future humans, particularly those who have the resources, they can replace parts that don't work. They can even genetically engineer their children. I mean, there's all sorts of possibilities that lead to some form of immortality or certainly vastly expanded lifespans that I think are very attractive to lots of people, and is becoming kind of a technological religion.
And you also talk about Silicon Valley developing a religion based on artificial intelligence.
Right. Well, that's, I mean, basically, when you start moving into the area of artificial intelligence, you begin to see ways in which we can, essentially replicate a divine power. I mean, at the highest level, AI to its enthusiasts represents the sort of movement into a higher consciousness, one that is, able to process information at a much faster rate, which has, in quote, a logical way of dealing with the world. And that has, for generations that are brought up in a technological atmosphere, this could become more and more important.
I remember, of course, science fiction is often quite prescient, and I do recall back in the early 70s, maybe, and I cannot remember what I was watching on TV. I believe it was a television show as opposed to a movie. But I remember people being able to go into this room, and there was this massive computer, because, of course, in the early 70s, all computers had to be massive. And someone was able to go to confession by entering into this room and having a conversation with a computer. So, they may be right. Go on.
I mean, I think it's entirely possible. Those of us who are of the older generation, hard for us to underestimate the role that technology may play. Certainly with certain people in our society for whom technology and artificial intelligence and virtual reality is reality. And where that may lead, I think, is something that religious leaders should be thinking about.
You mentioned the Greens, people in the environmental movement, and you say in your article that they have embraced hyperbole in such areas as the population bomb, resources depletion, et cetera, et cetera. Where are they right and where are they wrong? I mean, obviously, we are experiencing climate change. We are experiencing a significant amount of pollution, et cetera. But where do you think the Greens sort of went overboard?
Well, first of all, you start off with the idea that human beings are the problem. People shouldn't have children. People, that you want to just take a shot at the heart of society, that's a good start. The sort of moralizing, first of all, there are many things in the environment that are much better than they were. I mean, I remember when I moved first to Los Angeles in 1975, the smog was much worse. So, the idea that human agency can actually deal with some of these problems is important. The second thing is that there's been there seems to be no interest at all in how these policies might affect poor people, working families, people who want to buy a house, who want to make a living. That doesn't even seem to be part of it. And there's kind of a level of zealotry, where the people can never be satisfied, that you have to continually add more and more and more and more restrictions. It's very much almost the same language as the of the Catholic Church and other traditional religions at their absolute worst. And then the constant moral shaming all the time, shame on you. That's like, well, wait a minute. People did, A, they didn't know. B, they're going to try to improve things over time. And, of course, the apocalypse that's always there. One of the very few benefits of getting older is I've been through it before. I remember the early stages of the environmental movement, which, if you read what people were saying, this is before climate change. Oh, we're all going to be wearing gas masks in 10 years, that kind of thing. And then you read the claims. Well, we're never going to see, the snow is a thing of the past. The polar ice caps will be gone by 2000. I mean, one after another after another. Not that the processes are not taking place, but the constant attempt to say the world is coming to an end. And, that resonates with what exactly happened in the Middle Ages. There may have been something that was a serious problem, but it was the end of the world was coming. And that is a very negative thing. And frankly, I think it's bad for the environment, because once people get to that level where nothing is going to save it, they may not, try to work on sort of practical solutions.
Just throw up their hands is what you're saying.
And say, right.
Yeah, yeah. I get that. In the closing moments, Joel, tell us about the book that is coming out in May.
Yeah, in May, the book called The Coming of Neo-Feudalism will be out. And basically what it talks about is how we are beginning to repeat many of the very same things that we saw in the Middle Ages. We have stagnation of population. We have lower economic growth. We have concentration of wealth and power, the lack of upward mobility. So in many ways, we are reprising what happened in the Dark Ages in a way that I think no one would have predicted.
And this is out in May. One more time, the title?
The Coming of Neo-Feudalism.
Wonderful, wonderful. I so appreciate your time with us, Joel, both this this week and last week as well. And good luck with the new book.
Well, great. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Common Threads here on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella, and with me today has been Joel Kotkin. He is the co-author of the article, As the Old Faiths Collapse, The Greens, Social Justice Warriors, and Techno-Futurists Aim to Fill the Void. You can read that at the Daily Beast. And please join us again here next week for Common Threads on WGVU.